We are on page 28 of our notes, and we are these three things that I would like to look at. I know they're not on your notes, but they can be. If you did, you need. Some people skipped last time, so said he was in Texas or Mexico. So I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, it's just, we're so glad you're back. We missed you. But I hope these things that we're going to look at here, I hope they ring long and loud in your soul. I still remember one of the first times that these truths in Ezekiel just began to make more sense. I was sitting out at Divine Providence Nursing Home talking, listening to, some of you remember, Ewald Wellnitz. And long story short, but Ewald was reading through the scriptures, and he says, "Phil, you know, am I reading this right?" And so we started looking in this chapter and many others, and he said, "It just seems like it's, you know, it's God's doing what He's doing just for God." Okay. Yep. Now we receive benefit from it, right? But it's not all about us, right? As much as Joel Osteen would like to tell people, it is not about you and it's not about me. It's, well, let's look at these three things that I have on the board for you. There are three, and I did write the references in. Notice why God is doing what He's doing, verse 9, verse 14, verse 22, and verse 44. He says, "I'm going to do these things for the sake of my name." Okay? So that's His ultimate goal, right? Now, does God always accomplish His ultimate goal? Yeah, He does. Okay? Yes, He does. So, in fact, if God can do what He's going to do here in chapter 20, and He will, right, it will bring glory to God. If God can bring rebellious Israel to a point of restoration, verses 33 through 44, that'll bring glory to God, right? Because that's never happened before, right? So we need to think of that way. Look at verse, again, you can read, but I think the first, for instance, is in verse 9, "But I acted for the sake of my name, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations among whom they lived, in whose sight I made myself known to them by bringing them out of the land of Egypt." Now again, remember, if you have read post-Exodus, as you get into the book of Joshua, right, and they come to the city of Jericho, right? And with God's purpose in the Exodus, and you can see those in the book of Exodus, that God says, "I'm doing this so that you will know that I am Yahweh." Right? That's my purpose, for the sake of my name. And when they get to Jericho, what happens? Right? The prostitute says, "We have heard what Yahweh has done, and what? Our hearts melted within us." Right? So it worked, right? What God was trying to do in Exodus was accomplished. Now He has promised here again, "I am acting for the sake of my name." You see that again in verse 14. "But I acted for the sake of my name, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations." We've heard that before. Right? God's point is, I don't want you to think, and I don't want the surrounding nations to think, that I am somehow less than what I am, that I am somehow like the other gods and goddesses. My name, my reputation, my glory is at stake. Okay? You see it again in verse 22. He says, "But I turned back my hand and acted for the sake of my name." What? "That it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations in whose sight I brought them out." And then again in verse 44, he says, "Then you will know that I am Yahweh when I have dealt with you," what? "For my name's sake." So, and notice, by the way, how this goes along with Psalm 103 that we looked at Sunday. "Not according to your evil ways or according to your corrupt deeds," right? So God is dealing with us not based upon our sin, but upon his glory and reputation. So, "for the sake of my name." Now I want to show you these other two things, because one is the intention, and the second one is the accomplishment of that intention. Look at verse 12. He says, "And I also gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am Yahweh who sanctifies them." That's his intention. We see it again in verse 20. "Keep my Sabbaths holy, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am Yahweh your God." And then again down in verse 26, "And I pronounced them unclean because of their gifts, in that they caused all their firstborn to pass through the fire," in other words, child sacrifice with the god Molech, right? "To pass through the fire so that I might make them desolate in order that they might know that I am Yahweh." Okay, so this is God's, "I'm acting for the sake of my name, and I'm doing this so that you might know who I am," which is part of God's name, right? Getting to know God's name. Now, let's drop down to verse 38. In verses 38, 42, and 44, 38, 42, and 44, this is in the context now of the future restoration. Look at verse 38. "And I will purge you from the rebels and those who transgress against me. I will bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they will not enter the land of Israel." Now notice how this is worded. This is not intention. This is accomplishment. "Thus you will know that I am Yahweh." Okay? That's a big difference from "that you might know me." He says, "You will know me." Again, verse 42. "And you will know that I am Yahweh when I bring you onto the ground of Israel, into the land which I swore to give to your fathers." And then again, verse 44, "Then you will know that I am Yahweh when I have dealt with you for my name's sake, not according to your evil ways or according to your corrupt deeds, O house of Israel, declares Adonai Yahweh, the sovereign Yahweh." So I hope you see this, and I think it's extremely helpful for us to ponder that God is doing what he is doing ultimately, right, for his glory. Now, does Israel receive benefit from it? Yeah. But it is not merely for their benefit. It is for the sake of God's reputation, God's fame, God's name, God's glory. There's many different ways of making that statement. So let's back up, if we can, to chapter 20 and verses 1 through 32. And in this section, and we're not going to read every verse here, but the point of this section is to show us that Israel has a long history of rebellion. Like a really long history of rebellion. If they do not become a nation until 1445 BC at Mount Sinai, so 1445 until they are destroyed in 70 AD, right? So that's roughly 1,500 years, right? Give or take, right? 1,500 years of rebellion. That's a long time. That's older than, right? That's pretty old, right? It's older than Methuselah. You thought I was going to say Brad, but I didn't. It's older. Combine. But 1,500 years is a really, really long time for Israel to be in a relationship with the God of the universe and to reject him again and again and again and again and again. Right? Now, 1,500 years, and again, we sometimes get frustrated when we have to tell somebody a second time, right? Haven't I already told you? Yeah. Well, actually you did, yeah. But 1,500 years worth? Now, I'm a firm believer that God never gets frustrated. Okay? I know there are those who say that God does. I don't think so. God does not get frustrated. God does get angry, right? He does express his wrath. He does not get immediate obedience out of everybody, right? 1,500 years of telling the same group of people, love Yahweh your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. How many times? Right? Again and again and again. So this is he discusses with them in verses 5 through 9 what it was like in the land of Egypt. 400 years plus 430 years in the land of Egypt. 40 years in the wilderness near Beersheba. And then 1405 roughly when they come into the promised land. And into this land that God has graciously provided for them, the houses they did not build, vineyards they did not plant, all those things, they absorb all of that, but the problem is they also absorb the religion, right? They absorb the religion of all the Canaanites. And yet God has said, I am doing these things for the sake of my name, so it will not be profaned among the nations, and yet Israel, what have you done? You have profaned my name, right? You have sinned against me. You have habitually done this. And whether it is in the land, you say, well, it's in the land of Egypt. Of course, it was just too difficult in Egypt. So, all right, well, let's get out of Egypt. Let's get out into the wilderness where there is no world, right? There's no negative environment because there's nobody else out here, right? And yet, what does Israel do in the wilderness? Same thing. Why? Because they brought the sin with them, right? It's been in their heart while they were in Egypt, and it's in their heart when they're in the wilderness. Well, let's get into the promised land where it's a good environment, and then so we've gone from a negative environment in Egypt to a, if you will, neutral environment in the wilderness to now a positive environment in the promised land. Surely they'll obey. Or not, right? So it's not your environment, right? So he says, your rebellion has gone against God's intention, God's purpose. And the shocking thing is not verses 1 through 32. I would say, in one sense, the shocking thing is what we begin to read in verse 33. Now, in one sense, it's not to be shocking because God has already promised. Right? That he would bring them back. And yet, would you bring them back? Right? If this was somebody that you had interacted with for 15 or 1,400 years, whatever, would you bring them back? They don't deserve to be brought back. You're right. That's why it's called grace. Right? Look at verse 33. As I live, declares Adonai Yahweh. Now that's taking an oath, right? As I live. Now, remember the book of Hebrews. When people take an oath, what do? We take an oath by something greater than ourselves, right? Hebrews tells us what does God do when he takes an oath? He swears by himself, right? Because there is nobody greater, right? there is none greater. So he says, as I live, I'm taking an oath. This is what will happen. Surely with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out, I shall be king over you. Now, again, God doesn't have a hand. God does not have an arm, right? Because he's invisible, right? He is, God is spirit, so he doesn't have body parts. But what he is saying is, what does it take? What can you do with a strong hand? What can someone do with an outstretched arm, right? You can accomplish things, and it's an illustration of power and skill. So skillful, powerful hands, an outstretched arm, but also with wrath poured out, I shall be king over you, and I will bring you out from the peoples. Notice the plural. So they have been scattered, and gather you from the lands where you are scattered with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there I will enter into judgment with you face to face. Now again, God doesn't have a face, right? But you can come into his presence, right? That's the word picture here. God is going to interact with them in a very personal and very real manner. As I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so I will enter into judgment with you, declares Adonai Yahweh. And I will make you pass under the rod, which is an evaluation, right? It's the shepherd. This is not a rod, but this close thing I have for a rod. But the shepherds would hold the rod in their hand, and the sheep would come up, and he would start at the tip of their nose and run it over their bodies to the butt end, right? And the sensitivity, the shepherd had developed a sensitivity, so if there were any abnormalities in the sheep, he would feel it, okay? That's part of the evaluation. Now, the rod is also a demonstration of authority, right? The rod can be held this way. The rod can also be held this way, right? The word can also be used for scepter, right? So he can exercise his kingly authority. He says, I will make you, in other words, he's not saying I'm inviting you. He's not saying I really wish you would. He says, I will make you pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. Verse 38, and I will purge from you the rebels and those who transgress against me. I will bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they will not enter the land of Israel. In other words, unbeliever, there are certain aspects of unbelieving Israel will not be allowed to enter into the promised land in this future restoration. And what will be the result of that? End of verse 38. And thus you will know that I am Yahweh. Judgment. The division between believers and unbelievers is going to be very clear. Verse 39. So his direct actions in restoring Israel, and now his self-referential motive for restoring Israel, verse 39, and as for you, O house of Israel, thus says Adonai Yahweh, go, serve everyone his idols. But after this, you will surely listen to me. And my holy name you will profane no longer with your gifts and with your idols. In other words, what was Israel's dominating sin throughout their history? It was idolatry, right? But that will be removed. Verse 44, on my holy mountain, on the high mountain of Israel, declares Adonai Yahweh, there the whole house of Israel, all of them, will serve me in the land. Doesn't say they should. It doesn't say I hope they do. He says, no. They will. right? But the unbelieving have to be removed, and now the rest will be believers. And there I will accept them, and there I will seek your contributions and the choicest of your gifts and all your holy things. As a soothing aroma, I will accept you when I bring you out from the peoples and gather you from the lands where you are scattered, and I will prove myself holy among you in the sight of the nations. In other words, we've never seen a God like that. That's true. And what is the result of that? What? God is glorified, right? If he is acting for the sake of his name, and now people are saying, God is different than the rest of the gods and goddesses. He's being glorified, right? He's accomplishing his purpose. Verse 42, and you will know that I am Yahweh when I bring you onto the ground of Israel, into the land which I swore to give to your fathers. And there you will remember your ways and all your deeds with which you have defiled yourselves. And you will loathe yourselves to your own faces for all the evil things that you have done. In other words, what? Repentance. But can't you hear some of the psychologists and psychiatrists going, oh, that's not good. You should never loathe yourself. Yeah, you should. It's called repentance. And then you will know that I am Yahweh when I have dealt with you for my name's sake, not according to your evil ways or according to your corrupt deeds, O house of Israel, declares Adonai Yahweh. So God is doing this. He is bringing them to salvation. He is restoring them, but not merely for the good of Israel. Not merely that their sins will be forgiven. Why does John write to his readers in 1 John? He says, I've written you these things because your sins have been forgiven for his namesake, right? You say, well, I think it's just so great God forgives me and it's just wonderful. That's the best thing that can happen. Well, no, God forgives for his glory, right? Not just so you can feel better, not just so that your conscience can be cleansed. God is forgiving you so that he will be glorified, okay? And that is what we see demonstrated here. All right, before we go on to the next puzzling one in verses 45 through 49, any questions or comments over what we've looked at so far? Pretty straightforward stuff, but I hope that you see that it is not just about Israel being restored, which is still a good thing though, right? It's good that Israel's restored, but why is Israel restored? Okay, go ahead.
I have, again, over 1,500 years, I think, I come to church on Wednesday nights, I come to the church on Sunday mornings, and it's not just because I want to come to church or because I want to know God. We all do it for the same reason. It's for the sake of his name. It's to glorify the constant reminders that we need in our lives, which just would not be there otherwise.
Right. Yeah, and Israel came to the tabernacle. Israel comes to the temple. They could come every day if they wanted. They could come three times a year, right? Men were required to be there at least three times a year, right? Kind of like American Christianity. you know, Christmas and Easter, and do I got to have one more? I got to go one more time. No. But, you know, they were required to come those three times. But they would hear the singing, they would hear perhaps a prophet, they would hear, well, in Jesus' day, they could hear Christ teaching in the temple. But they would smell the sacrifices, right? Smell the blood, smell the smoke, smell the incense. You know, going into the temple or into the tabernacle was, and I mean this in the best use of the term, but it was a sensual, in the sense of sensory, maybe better use the word sensory experience. To hear, to see, to smell, right? To taste, because you could eat some of the sacrifices that you brought. It was sensory overload, and it could be, right? But you were coming into the presence of the God of the universe, right? Perhaps seeing the glory cloud, right? But whether they came weekly or monthly or three times a year or they came every day, there was intended to be those reminders. And we get the privilege of coming weekly or twice a week. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we are, as we sang earlier, right, prone to wander, prone to leave the God I love. All right, anything else before we move on? All right, let's look at verses 45 through 49. There's a parable here, a message about the forest in the land of the Negev. And the Negev is just a Hebrew expression for the wilderness. Now, we need to understand that the way Israel is today, agriculturally, geographically, does not mean that Israel has always been that way, right? So you go to the Negev today and you come back to Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 45 through 49, and you say, forest and Negev don't go together, right? So this is a puzzle, and as I've typed it in. There are very few trees. It is dry. It is, in some places, it looks very little different than the lunar landscape, okay? It is a desolate area. Is it possible that there were more trees back in the day? It's very possible. We do know that the Romans in the late 60s and into 70 AD did go in and cut down a whole bunch of trees, lots of trees, because it was their way of destroying, because that was Rome. Kind of their scorched earth policy, right? Were there more trees back in the day? That's possible, but it still, to me, is a puzzle. So when the word of Yahweh comes to Ezekiel in verse 45, God says to him, "Son of man, set your face toward Teman and speak." Dripping out words against the south and prophesy against the forest land of the Negev. That's a puzzle. And say to the forest of the Negev, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus says Adonai Yahweh, behold, I'm about to kindle a fire in you, and it will consume every green tree in you, as well as every dry tree. The blazing flame will not be quenched, and the whole surface from the south to the north will be scorched by it, and all flesh will see that I, Yahweh, have made it burn. So some sort of supernatural, not explainable by human intervention, they will say, Yahweh has made it burn, it shall not be quenched. And then I said, Ah, Adonai, Yahweh, they are saying of me, is he not just speaking parables? So it's a puzzle, and I don't have a great explanation for it. But his point is he will bring judgment upon the southern portion of the land of Israel. But Ezekiel is saying, in verse 49, he seems to struggle with the seeming ineffectiveness of his message because his audience seems to view him as someone not to be taken seriously. Oh, he's just speaking in riddles, speaking in parables, and we can't understand him, and there's no reason to even listen to him. So it's a difficult paragraph. And that's all I can say about this. I don't know about this forest fire, because I don't know about the forest. But I do know that the problem is not with what Ezekiel recorded. The problem is with my understanding of what Ezekiel recorded. So it's very possible that there was a time when there were more trees, or there will be a time when there will be more trees, because God says, I will burn up all the trees. So there have to be trees in there at some point in time. So, all right. That's just one of those you just have to go, and you pray and ask God to help you understand it in his time, and then you move on to the next paragraph. That's the best thing I would suggest for you. So, yes.
Is this a future prophecy even for us now in them, or is this something that was fulfilled after this was said?
He doesn't tell us, other than I'm inclined to think it could be more, I'm more inclined to think it is a future thing rather than a historic at this point, because all flesh will see it, and all flesh will see that I, Yahweh, have made it burn. In Old Testament times, I don't know how that would happen. How would all flesh see it? Unless it's just saying everybody in the area would see it. But usually all flesh means more than just the Bedouins out in the wilderness, right? It's a larger number of people. And how would they know? So there, I would be more inclined to think of it as a future event. So maybe what will happen is that as Israel continues to flourish in the land, when they're not spending money on removing Hamas, and put more money into horticulture, right, and be planting more trees, so which is possible. So, you have a question?
Well, I almost forgot what it was.
It's Brad's fault because he asked the question. Handel's Messiah.
Where?
No, I'm sorry.
In Revelation.
Yes. Yeah. It's used different places. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess it's a term that we kind of see throughout.
Right.
It is repeated.
It seems to be a concept of universality, more than just, as I said earlier, more than just a few of the Bedouin people who are out in the desert at the moment. Mm-hmm. Seems to be that this is going to have universal implications. Yeah. So, go ahead.
As a conjecture, thanks for Canadian wildfires. Though we haven't seen, we do see the smoke of that. If there's something of that sort that you see,
yeah,
where all the smoke comes from.
It's the Canadians. Yeah. It's the but could be. That's an interesting concept because of the weather patterns of the Middle East. I could see. I hadn't thought of that, but that I could see how that could have an impact. The because there's a, I know it's a migration thing, but there's a migration flow from Africa up on into Asia, and as those winds, as those birds ride along with some of those southerly winds that come up through there, I could see something like that, or you have the winds blowing from different directions impacting. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So there is, and again, without getting too far as imagination, it's You also would have satellite, if it is future, the potential for satellite imagery and being broadcast in such a way that people could be aware of those things. So, yeah, good. All right. Anything else? Yeah, yeah.
It also says forest, but it also says, you know, verse 49.
Yeah, he is speaking in parables. He is speaking in riddles. He is, we don't understand, right? Even Ezekiel's original audience was going, right? Kind of the expressions you have when you have to listen to me. So it's like, his lips are moving, but what is he saying? So that seems to have been the case here with Ezekiel too. But I, Caleb, back to yours, I don't remember any of the commentaries, even those that are prone to be less literal. I don't know that any of them ever went to a, it was just, yeah, yeah. But it is a curious paragraph, isn't it? To me, it's just one of those things that, and then we've said this before, but this is not a paragraph that you should pick your life's verse from, right? If you know what I mean. It's just, you got favorite verses, and it's good to have favorite verses. But this would be one I would encourage you to maybe find another paragraph, if you will. All right. Chapter 21, real quick. Chapter 21 deals with God's sword, and I don't know how far we'll get to this, but there are two aspects of this sword, and maybe this is as far as we'll get, is the first one. But we see, first of all, in chapter 21, verses 1 through 7, it is a drawn sword. The word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face toward Jerusalem and speak, dripping out words against the sanctuaries, plural, and prophesy against the land of Israel. Now, some Hebrew copies will say sanctuaries, plural, and some will say sanctuary, singular. So, as I've typed in there, if it is plural, then it probably refers to the many shrines and the places of the high places, the places of worship of false gods and goddesses. If it is a singular sanctuary, it probably refers to the temple. So the Legacy Standard Bible takes it as a plural. But he says, and say to the land of Israel, verse 3, thus says Yahweh, behold, I am against you, and I will bring out my sword from its sheath, and will cut off from you the righteous and the wicked. Because I will cut off from you the righteous and the wicked, therefore my sword will go out from its sheath against all flesh from north to south. South to north. Thus all flesh will know that I, Yahweh, have brought out my sword from its sheath. It will not return to its sheath again. So Yahweh is the ultimate source of this judgment. Now, this sword is probably a reference to Babylon, right? God is using Babylon to accomplish God's purpose here. So Babylon is the immediate source, and Babylon is also an indiscriminate instrument of judgment. They didn't care what they destroyed, kind of like the Romans. Okay, we're here to destroy. Doesn't matter, right? They not always wise in their exercise of their power. But look at verse 6. Now as for you, son of man, groan with breaking heart and bitter grief. Groan in their sight. In other words, Ezekiel is to be mourning. Now if this is in the same time frame that the earlier message that took place there in 591, so Babylon is going to come in and their final destruction of Jerusalem is 586, right? So they got about 5 years. So he's mourning a future event. So he knows it's going to happen and it impacts him in such a way, and God tells him that you're going to grieve and make sure you do it publicly. Groan in their sight. Say, well, I'm a man and I don't cry in public. Well, God says to Ezekiel, you're a man and cry in public. Right? Shed your tears, groan in their sight. And it will be that when they say to you, why do you groan? You shall say, because of the report that is coming. In other words, what? It's a future event. It is coming. And what's going to happen? And every heart will melt. Now again, obviously a figure of speech, right? Has to be. And all hands will fall limp. Every spirit will faint. And all knees will be weak as water. I refer to them as Tony Oliva knees because he has nothing left in his knees. Poor guy can't hardly stand up. Behold, it is coming and it will happen, declares Adonai Yahweh. So he is grieving, and this, he is so in tune, so attuned to what God is revealing that it is a source of grief to him. It is not merely a scare tactic. It is something that is going to happen, and he grieves over it. So I think for sake of time, we'll stop here with the drawn sword and pick up next time with the sharpened sword. But